from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Coming up first, escalating tensions in the Middle East this morning as Iran threatens to violate the nuclear agreement it signed with the Obama administration in 2015 unless Europe pushes back against economic sanctions imposed by President Trump. Then at 9:30, CNN's chief White House correspondent Jim Acosta has been a regular thorn in President Trump's side. He even had his White House press pass revoked temporarily until a federal judge reinstated it. Well, now Acosta has written a book about covering the Trump administration in the era of so-called fake news. It's titled The Enemy of the People. He'll join us to talk about that and more, and we'll get started right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by CNN's chief White House correspondent, Jim Acosta. He's written a new book titled The Enemy of the People. But we begin with Iran. This morning, a spokesman for its Atomic Energy Organization announced live on Iranian television that it was 10 days away from exceeding limits on nuclear fuel, threatening to violate the nuclear agreement that Iran signed with the United States and other nations in 2015 unless Europe helps reduce the impact of economic sanctions against Iran. All this, of course, comes a week after the Trump administration accused Iran of attacking two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman, something that Iran denies. Joining us to talk about all this is Barbara Slavin. She's director of the Future of Iran Initiative. Barbara Slavin, good morning.
You're welcome. Good morning.
And also joining us, BBC Persian correspondent Kashayar Jonaidi, who joins us from London, I believe. From Washington, rather.
Yes, from Washington. From Washington.
Good morning to you. Let me begin with you, Kashayar. What is the significance of the announcement that Iran's Atomic Energy Organization made today?
Well, this goes back to May 8th, when on the first anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement, Iran announced that it will stop adhering to some parts of the agreement, which include the limit that the agreement had imposed on the stockpiles of Iran's low-grade uranium and also the heavy water stockpiles that Iran had. This was Iran's response to the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the deal that happened a year before that. And Iran gave the Europeans a two-month ultimatum to find a way to ease the pressure on Iran. Iran is suffering extensively under the economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. administration, so it's looking for a way to really start get free from these pressure. It needs money. It can't sell oil.
And
other problems.
And the U.S. is very much telling its allies not to do that, right?
Of course, and it's been very effective. So one of the restrictions that the JCPOA imposed on Iran was that it had a limit of 300 kilograms of enriched uranium stockpiles, and the stockpiles shouldn't exceed this amount. And now Iran is announcing that its stockpiles are going to exceed this amount in 10 days. The European Union is saying that they are not going to react according to the rhetoric they're hearing from Iran. They'll wait for the International Atomic Agency's report to make a decision on this new development.
And when would that report be likely due?
Soon.
So within days?
I'm not sure, frankly.
Yeah. Barbara Slavin, what would you add to that in terms of the significance of the agreement and what it says about the pressure that the United States is applying on Iran?
Yeah. Well, first, I think the next report comes out in August, unless they choose to do something special. These are not surprising developments. The United States violated the agreement by pulling out of it a year ago when Iran was in full compliance. The Iranian government has waited for a year to see if the Europeans could come up with some viable way of continuing trade with Iran. That hasn't happened so far. So we shouldn't be surprised that we are where we are. I think that the deal is essentially dead. I think this is just putting a fork in it. If the Iranians exceed the limits on low enriched uranium. And of course, there are other steps they can take. And I almost see that we're now in a phase where people are preparing for the next negotiations on an agreement that would follow the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as the deal is known. The Trump administration essentially killed this agreement when it withdrew and put an oil embargo on Iran, which is something we have not seen, I think, since the British tried to embargo Iranian oil back in the 1950s when they were angry that the Iranians had nationalized oil. So we took extreme steps, and now we're seeing the results.
I'm wondering, you know, that Trump's defense secretary and I think most of the Joint Chiefs of Staff all urged him not to withdraw from the agreement. Do you have any sense, Barbara Slavin, what they're thinking now about this latest escalation?
I'm not privy to the private consultations of the Trump administration. I hope they realize that their strategy has failed. They complained that the agreement did not deal with other aspects of Iranian policy, you know, what they call Iran's quote-unquote malign behavior, its regional interventions, and so on. And what they've gotten is an Iran that seems to be more aggressive, not less. And that is not going to stay within the confines of this nuclear agreement, which has ramifications for non-proliferation throughout the region. So it's really a failed policy, in my view.
And Kashyar, how is Europe reacting this morning to this?
Well, the Europeans, from day one, from May 8, when Iran announced that it's going to stop adhering to parts of the JCPOA, the Europeans were not happy. They saw this as a ultimatum that Iran is giving them, and they are not happy with such warning. And you could see also this kind of reaction today from the European capitals, from Germany, from Britain, from other places. But Federico Mogherini, the EU's top diplomat, says that they would not act on the basis of what Iran is saying. They will just wait for the IAEA's report and see what their assessment is. I have to add that in previous reports, since the time that the nuclear agreement has been signed, IAEA has always reported that Iran has been adhering to the agreement and has not done otherwise.
Other than making Israel happy, which I'm sure this does, pulling out of the agreement, Barbara Slavin, what effect is the Trump administration getting out of this?
Well, President Trump campaigned on this, right? He said it was the worst deal ever negotiated, which was certainly not the case. I doubt he had read it when he made those comments. This is something that makes his major donors like Sheldon Adelson happy, because they didn't like the agreement. They felt that it was too lenient and had too many loopholes in it that Iran could exploit. As you pointed out, it makes Bibi Netanyahu happy, and that in turn makes Trump happy, and also the Saudis and the Emiratis, who were angry that the deal did not put restrictions on Iran's regional interventions. It makes them happy, too. Anything that weakens Iran makes them happy, too. So, you know, from the Trump administration's point of view, if their goal is to weaken Iran, if that's, you know, that's really what it is, it's not about negotiating a new agreement, then maybe they're not that unhappy. I think what's troubling is that this sets in train a possible escalation with Iran that could be bad for the United States as well as all the other actors in the region.
And Kashyar Junaidi, I know you need to leave in a few minutes, very shortly. But before you go, where is this leading, do you think? Like, what's the next move?
Well, before I answer to this question, please let me second on what Barbara said about regional actors. I was a correspondent in the Middle East back then when the nuclear agreement was signed. And it was obvious that people in the Gulf, people in other parts of the Middle East, Israel, even Turkey, were not really happy with the deal. They considered this as a way of opening Iran's hand, and they saw this as a way of supporting Iran and helping Iran get stronger. And when Trump decided to withdraw from the JCPOA, you could see that the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Israelis were happy because they would see that this is going to put further pressure on Iran and weaken Iran. And that's what they want, to weaken Iran. So what you're seeing now, the escalation of tensions in the Persian Gulf region, in the Gulf of Oman, all of this is somehow byproduct of President Trump's policy. This is like the tension is there because, first of all, this tension shouldn't have been created at the first place. If there was a problem with the JCPOA, if there were imperfections, the agreement itself had venues for trying to solve those imperfections. Unilaterally getting out of the deal created more trouble for the Europeans in the region, for the Iranians, for other players. And now what you see in the Persian Gulf, the military escalation is a byproduct of President Trump's policy of getting out of the nuclear deal. And frankly, nobody knows what the end game is going to be. The tension is so high that a wrong move by one of the players could have unwanted consequences. Both sides say they don't want war, but the tensions are so high that they are really dangerous.
All right. Kashyar Junaidi is the BBC's Persian correspondent joining us this morning from Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate that.
You're most welcome.
And let's open up the phone lines now. The number to call if you want to join us on this news that Iran is expanding its uranium stockpiles, perhaps signaling the end of the nuclear deal that the United States withdrew from a little over a year ago. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org, or you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Barbara Slavin, let me just follow up with you the same question I put to Kashyar, which is, where do you think this is going? Is this going to bring Iran to the table somehow? I mean, are they going to make concessions? I mean, neither one of these administrations seem likely to sort of back down.
Yeah, well, I think the United States' next move will probably be to go to the UN Security Council if Iran breaches the limits, and will do what was allowed under the nuclear deal, namely ask that the UN Security Council snap back all the sanctions that were lifted under the agreement. So far, what we have is just the United States, which has reimposed sanctions. Of course, it's had a devastating effect because the U.S. Financial system and so on dominates the world, and other countries have been reluctant to trade with Iran and risk U.S. sanctions. But if all the sanctions under U.N. authority snap back, you know, that will mean that the deal is essentially dead. Iran will be deprived even symbolically of the benefits of the agreement, which were supposed to sort of take Iran out of the international doghouse, so to speak, and take its file out of the UN Security Council. All of that will be gone, and then you really, you know, can stick a fork in it, as I say. And then, will there be new negotiations? I mean, that's the question. The Supreme Leader of Iran told the Prime Minister of Japan, who visited Tehran last week, that he would not talk to Donald Trump. And I don't think that he will, or that any Iranian will, unless the U.S. begins to suggest, maybe through back channels, that it's willing to offer some concessions, maybe lighten up a little bit on the economic sanctions.
Yeah. And as I said at the top, all this, of course, is coming days after the U.S. accused Iran of attacking those two oil tankers. And we're hearing now that some of our allies, Germany and Japan, want more evidence. There seems to be a credibility problem with the Trump administration in terms of convincing our allies that what they say happened really did.
Yeah, well, look, this is an administration. I mean, the president of the United States, according to fact checkers, lies 8 times a day. It's also a president who doesn't seem to believe his own intelligence community. So, you know, why should we believe them now? I personally think Iran probably was responsible for these attacks. And I think that what the Europeans and others are doing is saying, we're not going to give you a pretext for military action. So we're going to say that we're not convinced.
But why would Iran do that, given the already heightened tensions?
Again, it's to show that it will not be put under an oil embargo, that its economy will not be strangled without the international community paying some kind of price. I mean, fortunately, nobody has been killed so far, but the price of oil has bumped up a little bit. And of course, that benefits Iran because whatever little amount of oil it can sell for more. As I pointed out, I mean, you know, the Iranians have been rather patient. And this is not to say this is a good move. I think it's a terrible move. But from their perspective, it's one of the few things that they can do to get the attention of the international community.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. We're talking this half hour with Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative, in light of Iran's announcement this morning that it plans to basically end its part of the nuclear deal. It's expanding its uranium stockpiles. The number to call, 866-733-6786. And let's go to Wynn in Menlo Park. Welcome. Wynn, are you there? Oh, John, I'm sorry. John in San Jose, you're next.
Hi, yes. My comments is, well, first of all, let me say this because some people jump into incorrect conclusions. I oppose any kind of military conflict between the U.S. and the regime in Iran. However, what I wanted to say is that from, you know, watching the events between Iran and the U.S. For many years, several decades closely, what I see is that one of the main problems that have caused the issues between Iran and the U.S. is that the administrations, whether Democrat or Republican, have made incorrect assumptions about the regime in Iran and the actors over there, the leaders of the regime. And based on those incorrect assumptions, they've made incorrect decisions. I mean, if you look at it, Carter made mistakes with the regime in Iran. Reagan sent Oliver North and his buddies over there. And you can follow it all the way to today. So as long as you make incorrect assumptions, and you're, you know, basically one of the incorrect assumptions has been this business of good mullah and bad mullah, that they're always waiting for the good mullah to come out on top so that they can make a deal. And, you know, as long as you make these incorrect assumptions, you're going to have the same problems.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Barbara, your thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, I don't think the Obama administration was making that kind of distinction. You know, the Iranian regime has very complicated politics and factions, that's true. But the decision to negotiate the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was made by the regime as a whole. The decision to accept the provisions of that agreement were made, you know, the decision was made by the regime as a whole. And so I think that that the Obama administration correctly understood the sort of makeup of forces within the government. They have something called a Supreme Council of National Security. It has representatives of the Supreme Leader, who is a clerical leader who has the last word on everything, the commanders of the various branches of the armed forces, the president of the country, the Speaker of the Parliament, and so on. So I think the system is perfectly capable of making decisions and operating in a coherent way. And I think what we're seeing now is the pushback that has come from the failure of the nuclear deal to provide the benefits that were promised the Iranians.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and now we'll go to Wynn in Menlo Park. Welcome.
Thanks. Does this Iranian announcement open the door for the Chinese and the Russians to establish more stronger relationships with Iran?
Good question. Barbara?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think they already have. I mean, both the Chinese and the Russians have been the beneficiaries of the Trump administration's efforts to isolate Iran. China is already Iran's number one trading partner. You know, Iran doesn't really have very many other places it can go. It's trying to increase its trade with its regional neighbors, but China is very important. If the Chinese choose to defy the United States and buy large quantities of Iranian oil, they alone could keep the Iranian economy afloat, and they know that. Of course, the Russians have gotten very cozy with Iran in Syria, where the two have worked together to prop up the regime of Bashar al-Assad.
Do Russia and Iran, are they sort of competitors in terms of the oil market?
Not so much competitors. I mean, they both benefit from higher prices. Certainly the Russians are enjoying any bump up in prices. But strategically, they cooperate more and more. And again, the nuclear deal, you know, Iranians normally look toward the West. They've been oriented toward the West. They like Western products. And many, many Iranians live in the diaspora, not only in the United States, but also in European countries. And after this deal was reached, there was a hope and expectation that a lot of members of the diaspora would come back and invest in Iran, lots of new businesses would start, and so on. So, you know, by collapsing the deal, what this does is strengthen those elements, primarily in the security and intelligence services in Iran, that look much more toward the authoritarian governments in Russia and China as a model for Iran. And that that's unfortunate, too.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Stephen in Napa, you're next.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'm sorry. I'm just curious where the sane diplomacy comes into play here. We all know about the saber rattling and the feckless incompetency of the American administration. What actors are going to be able to come into this with some sanity and clarity and come to a reasonable conclusion about solution about what to do about this?
That's an interesting question. I mean, Barbara Slavin, we like to sometimes think of ourselves, or some do, as an indispensable nation when it comes to maintaining order in the world and rule of law. This sort of flies in the face of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid that we are the indispensable nation, though, when it comes to economic sanctions because of the role of the dollar in the international financial system. So, you know, we have lots of would-be peacemakers out there. I mean, there's been a whole parade of them coming to Tehran from, you know, the foreign minister of Oman, the foreign minister of Germany, the prime minister of Japan was just there for the first time in 40 years.
What do you think think they're asking or telling the Iranian regime?
Well, all of them are urging Iran not to leave the nuclear agreement, not to take other provocative steps, to somehow hang in there. But the Iranians are saying, okay, fine, show us the money. You know, are you going to buy our oil? Are you going to do something to help us take care of our people? And if you can't do that, you know, thanks but no thanks. I think this is really something that has to be negotiated between the U.S. and Iran. If you remember when all of this started back in 2002, I think the Iranian nuclear program, the aspects of it that worry us, were discovered and announced. And the Europeans rushed in, Britain, France, and Germany, to try to sort of fill the gap because George W. Bush didn't want to be bothered talking to Iran. He was too busy doing regime change in Iraq. But it was only when the United States joined the talks that they actually finally got somewhere. So I think, you know, the Iran and the United States have to come to terms. I just question the capability and the will of the Trump administration to have a negotiation on a realistic basis.
All right. Barbara Slavin, thank you so much for joining us. Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative with the Atlantic Council. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
And I wanted to bring you some breaking news that we're getting on the wire. Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected president, died in an Egyptian courtroom on Monday. That's being reported by Egyptian state television. Morsi was 67 years old. He was Egypt's first freely elected presidential election in 2012. He won that, but then the military dissolved parliament later that year, ousted Mr. Morsi in 2013. You may recall he was on trial on espionage charges when he fainted and died. Egyptian television, again, reporting this morning that Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected president, has died. I'm sure we'll be following that. NPR will be following that throughout the day. I'm Scott Schaefer. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Jim Acosta, CNN's White House correspondent, will be with us.